As I said, my photographic history rather came to a check at the time of this dancing school. In the same building was a photographer named Cow, K-O-U-G-H. And my mother and sister led me down to the photographic gallery while I was dressed up for dancing school, one of the few times they would catch me in such a costume. Then they together posed me for the photograph, not jointly, but I might say differentially. Each one took a turn at putting me in the posture that they thought would be best for the photograph. And in those days, they generally had you leaning on scenery, and they'd always have a prop back of your head to keep your head still, because there were time exposures. And in this particular case, they had me sitting on a log, a piece of scenery. And they didn't agree at all as to how I was to sit. And one would pose me a little bit, and then the other would pose me. And finally, they reached an agreement and took their hands off me, and I went over backwards. They left me only on two points of support, so that I didn't remain for the photograph. I fled, because it was too much for me. But my mother was hugely amused with this. My sister was very furious about it, that they should get me into a position where I went over backwards when they let go their grip on me. 13. Was your family financially hit by the Depression in the 1890s? Well, this opens up quite a special streak of history of the family. My father had gone to Fayette County to accept a position, a secretarial position, either secretary or treasurer, of the Dunbar Furnace Company, which this husband of his sister had procured for father. In the same company was a Mr. Bliss from Muscle Shoals, as I recall, Alabama. They were compatriots, as it were. They're both men of the southern touch up in the colder stratum of the north, and they were both hard workers. As I recall, they joined forces, and while they continued on their jobs, they purchased a brickworks right close by, which was very profitable. And as soon as they got the brickworks out of debt, they then ventured into coal mines and coke ovens. And finally, they had developed a very large installation about 6 or 8 miles north of up the railroad, as we would say, from Uniontown, called Fair Chance, F-A-I-R, which has now been consolidated into one word. After they'd gotten these large installations of ovens built, and Father was a great expert on the building of the Beehive Oven, and had gotten in the mine opened, or mines, and they'd gotten the tracks in for the freight cars, they had a very heavy burden of debt to carry. So, it being very good times, they made a most successful sale to H.C. Frick. I don't know whether it's Frick and Company, but H.C. Frick was the principal. Frick and my father had been associates in his younger days up there. I remember Father had a frock coat and silk hat with trousers, which he'd won in a bet with Frick. However, they had become completely disassociated. Frick went in for the financial end, and Father followed the operative end. And the Oliver interest and the Frick interest were the predominant interest in the coal region. And this region was largely founded on the famous 7-foot vein of Connellsville coal. Father made quite a handsome sum of money out of this sale, and as a young man was in a very prosperous position. He then made the great mistake of his life, and much against my mother's advice, by investing in this land boom which swept over the Virginia and that region at that time, just prior to the financial crash. Just how they expected this thing to prosper, I don't know. It is like the South Sea bubble. However, his interests were largely in the vicinity of Luray, Virginia. And in addition to making this heavy investment in it, even to the interest money on his recent profits, he signed himself in one document without putting the word president after it, which legally made him responsible for everything and which wiped out every cent he had. Because the failure came, of course, as it did all over that region. All these land companies blew up, and Father went down with a crash and had to accept, I believe, though I'm not so certain about this, bankruptcy as his state for quite some time to come. It was quite a long time after that when he either recovered possession or in some way had maintained possession of a small, rather small, coke and coal plant nearby, which was on the Gist farm that I've mentioned before, right across from the famous Washington farm. That's right off the Braddock Trail. He held on to this for up to the time he died, and he and Mr. Bliss, I don't believe Mr. Bliss was interested in this. He was involved with another family who had loaned him some of the money, and stipulated that a certain relative of theirs was to be employed, which was not at all helpful to Father. So the days of my boyhood from the 1890 crash up to the time I went away to school were very limited financially, and only my mother's very modest income from some property she still held in Pittsburgh saved the situation. I know when I was going to the VMI, she had put aside the money, or succeeded in having Father put aside the money, for my brother and sister's schooling. But that was not done for me, because I was much younger then. And now, when my turn came to go away, it was the greatest difficulty that Mother scraped up enough money to get me entered at the VMI. And I remember very well that after I was in my second or third year there, she told me that there wasn't going to be enough money to continue my education. And then she found she had one lot that she had hoped to build on there, and she sold that lot, and that carried me through the remainder of my education at the VMI. We had to economize very bitterly. It was exceedingly hard on my mother. She had to do everything. She not only kept house, but she did everything in the house. And this continued all through that period immediately following the 90s and up to about 1899. I know when I graduated from the VMI in 1901, we were still in a state of very strict economy. So I was quite accustomed to that sort of a life, which wasn't my natural reaction, because I was very careless about money, indifferent about money matters. Now, of course, I had to be very, very careful. My allowance, I know, at the VMI for the first 3 years was $5 a month, and my roommate Nicholson took care of that for me. My last year, it was $7 a month. That took in everything, girls, dances, and all. But I might say, interject now, that while I went to dancing school at home and the little dances we had there, I didn't go to any dances at the VMI for almost 2 years. The life of a rat, as they called them there, was so humble that I chose not to try any social engagements. I don't quite understand the question. I think I catch the meaning, though. Uniontown was a very conservative community. There were several old families there that dated way back almost to George Washington's day. And while the name sounds new, Uniontown, it actually was very, very old. They were very conservative, and they led a very restricted, constrained life. Father came up from the South, mother came up from the South, and it was a long time before they were fully accepted in that circle. There were many others of the newer families that joyfully accepted them, because father was very convivial and liked people, and they liked him, and mother, of course, was a woman that commanded respect anywhere, though she was not particularly socially inclined. But for a long time, I know, there was a restriction to our social activities, in relation to some of these oldest inhabitants, particularly those that are concerned with the gentleman who owned the pool table in which the head of Christ was crowned with thorns, which got me into trouble.
That again.
Five. My father took a deep interest in politics, but he came to a highly Republican town with a Democratic instinct from his Southern exposure. He remained very much interested, I think, until the end. I think at one time he was party chairman, but they seldom were ever successful because they were generally swamped by the Republican vote. But he never gave up. The organization was against him, and his associates were very reputable but very solemn and uninspiring men. My political views at that time are largely those of my mother's. She was inclined to be Republican in her instincts, but she didn't have much to say out of respect for father with his intense Democratic feelings. We had no congressman from home. He lived in some other region, and I never saw him, and I knew nothing really about him. The first time, as I recall, that I had any connection with that was when I was standing at the desk at the New Willard Hotel when it was just new and on my honeymoon, and Mrs. Marshall was waiting for me when this man came up and introduced himself either as the congressman from home or associated with somebody from home politically and wanted to meet me and meet my wife. I think I've mentioned the association of my father with Mr. Bliss. There was a very close friendship between the families. Mother and Mrs. Bliss were very fond of each other and very intimate. The Blisses lived in the old home of the head of the stage company on the National Pike. Stockton, I think, was his name. And it was a very fine old house and always intrigued me because it had an extension which was attached to the house by an arch under which came the coaches right outside the dining room bay windows. As to question 18, I think that is quite correct. My mother exercised the most profound influence on my life. And Dr. Whiteman, John R. Whiteman, undoubtedly did also. The point with him was he was a new minister. He succeeded an English minister who had been the minister at St. Peter's Church for, I think, about 30-odd years and died in the pulpit, incidentally. Well, he was very conservative, and he had a very conservative backing. And when poor young Mr. Whiteman came, he had a very difficult time. As a matter of fact, he left in the end. I don't recall. I think I'd gone off to school at the time he left. And there was no club then at which men would meet, and all the men worked, as I've referred to before. So there was almost no associate during the workaday periods for Mr. Whiteman, and there was no club where he might meet them at night. And they didn't entertain very much. So the net result was, particularly during vacation periods, Mr. Whiteman and I used to take long walks, and he seemed to be very glad of his association with me, because I was literally the only person that he had to go around with at that hour of the day and time. And I came to know him very intimately, and I was very much impressed by him. I don't ever recall his exerting any influence on me, but he undoubtedly did, and profoundly. Boyhood friends, 19. Among those you mentioned, I would have to go into a little better description. There were the members of the Gad Blacksmith Shop crowd who loafed there. That would be largely my chum and myself and one or two others. Will Wood, as you have it, which we call Bill Wood, whose father ran a harness shop, and Bill's place was beyond my chum's place. He was a very frequent daily associate in our playtime, and I was very fond of him. Bill died rather early in life, but he ran a very successful shop for making stogies, which was the popular smoke there in those days. Bill was sort of a philosophic frame of mind and became, I think, rather influential politically, but that was after I had left home. Frank Llewellyn was an older man in the carriage shop who I kept in contact with through many years after they moved out to California and I became fairly prominent, then I would hear from him quite often. Mary Kate O'Brien was a young girl. She must have been about 4 years or more, maybe much more, younger than I was, and I didn't remember her very well. I never saw her father that I recall. I never saw her mother that I recall. But he occupied a very romantic place in the opinion of Andy Thompson and myself, because he was the night engineer on a train, which to us was very dramatic. Helen Houston was one of my girlfriends who lived nearby. Adele Bliss was another one. Catherine Lindsay, who's now Mrs. Egbert Armstrong and a widow living in Richmond, Virginia. There were two or three other girls whose names I will remember in a little bit. But those were the particular ones of my early youth. Catherine Lindsay had a sister named Nanny Lindsay, who was a little younger, but went with our crowd. And I was very fond of her. I hear from Catherine occasionally now, though she and I are both getting well up in years. My principal intimates at Miss Thompson's school were Andy and Jim Conrad, Billy Ewing a little bit. O'Neill Kennedy was younger than I was, but I remember him quite distinctly. Jim Conrad did very well at school, as well as Catherine Lindsay, and I did very, very poorly. Didn't I tell once about the spelling bee?
I think you did, but it might be good to recall it.
I think I told you about the spelling bee, which I made my first heavy effort in studying in order to get up to the head of the class, which was held by Catherine Lindsay, who was the pretty girl I was devoted to, though she didn't pay much attention to me. And after what I thought was a terrific effort, I moved up to number two in the class and was only there a day when I got spelled down, and I never studied after that for many years. I remember Billy Ewing very well. He had a goat cart which he could sit up in, and he came down with his goat cart, which was a very rare thing for him, as he was very conservatively brought up and he didn't play with we boys, though he wanted to, but his father, who was a widower and a judge, had him very closely held in. And Billy came down with his goat cart and turned into our yard and drove around into the general boydom of the orchard and the creek when one of our prize cats, a big Maltese, took after the goat. And I think Billy's cart was not a goat cart, but a big dog cart. And the cat went out of the yard sitting on the dog's head, and Billy in the runaway. He was upset outside, and it ended in a total disaster, but of course very much amused all the rest of us. Jap Shepler was considerably younger than I was. I knew him quite well, and his sister, Mary Shepler, strange to say, is married and lives here at Pinehurst. Sid Bigley must have been much younger than I was, because I don't remember him. Herbert Bowman was the great athlete, Yale athlete I've referred to. Ed Husett was a very close friend of mine, and he was a fine bicycle rider and a very handsome fella and very much liked by everyone. It was his father who was in command of a troop of cavalry, which was the escort to a battery of artillery commanded by Senator DuPont at the Battle of Newmarket, where the VMI cadets fought. And they watched this advance of this famous charge, and when they finally made out these were boys, they then decided that they would send their son to this school, whatever it was. Ed Husted's father, Captain Husted as we called him, did this, and he sent his older brother to the VMI, but he only stayed a year, I think, and didn't like the strict discipline, and went to Lawrenceville and to college. Ed did the same thing. He didn't go to the VMI. His father was very much disappointed, and I know after I went there, they would always ask me to call on them and tell them how I was getting along, and they took great pride in the fact that I gradually went up till I was first captain. I'll tell another delightful period of my boyhood. Mrs. Houston was an awfully sweet woman, and they had a rich farm out in the country, and therefore they had lots of milk and cream, things of that sort. She would mix ice cream for us. She'd put all the things that belonged in it, the fresh strawberries or fresh peaches or whatever was current at the time. And then Ed would call us up and we would go out there and we froze the cream down in the cellar and we ate it. We cut for who would get to lick the dasher, and then we ate ice cream. We had such a pain in our forehead we couldn't eat any more. But I've always remembered that business of Mrs. Houston fixing things up for us. She would never come down. She'd get it all ready, and then we would just gorge ourselves. You mention certain names and ask about them. The White Swan. The White Swan was a tavern from the earliest days of the Pike, which was only a block and a half from my home. It is on the side of the hill. I've described the great cobbled courtyard inside, and I've never was inside the building up above. It is frame and a series of individual buildings connected up, and it was run in my day by a fine old character called Natty Brownfield. And it was Natty Brownfield's butchering the hogs in the fall, which always fascinated us, on the border of this cobblestone courtyard. Gilmore's Hill was about a block and a half on the other side of our house, leading out the National Pike towards Wheeling, Virginia, and Mrs. Bliss's mother was Mrs. Gilmore, and that was their property, and therefore it was called Gilmore's Hill. Across the street, which was on a much lower level, was another home, a very nice home, that was owned by Mr. Thompson's sister. Her husband had died rather unexpectedly and early of pneumonia, and Mrs. Thompson inherited, Mrs. Nichols was her name, inherited quite a lot of money, and I think was led into better money by her brother, Mr. Thompson. Her daughter, Lida Nichols, had been left money outright by her father, who didn't dream of his dying so early, so she inherited this while she was still in her teens, and she is now the Princess of Thurn and Taxis, but a widow, I believe. I used to hear from Lida quite frequently. The last time was on my 75th birthday, but she used to dictate into records and send them to me on her views on political questions when I was Secretary of State. I might say that very frequently she didn't agree with me. You mentioned a horse named Old Billy. I'm sorry, but my memory doesn't carry me to Old Billy. You speak of a hired man named Fred Hallow. I don't remember him. But it seemed to me maybe you were talking about First Hollow, which was one of our boyhood playgrounds back in the country. Hospital Hill was named after my day. The hospital was built after my day, but it was out of town about a mile and a half. And the Gilmore place, which was the brother of Mrs. Bliss, was right there and gave it its name. Your statement as to Flicker was correct. I don't recall a nickname for any of the boys. All my friends, they were called by an abbreviation of their first name as a rule. Herb instead of Herbert, and Andy instead of Andrew, and so on. Boyhood incidents. You say Fry quotes Alec Meade saying that I was very fond of licorice candy. I don't recall that. I know we used to make licorice water, and we're very heartbroken when they all froze and we lost all the bottles broke. Crane's story, I think, is Crane's store. I think it's a mistake. Kramer, K-R-A-M-E-R, was the store. It was very small, and it had the conventional open barrel of oyster crackers and the tight barrel of dill pickles. And we were allowed to loaf in there, I guess much to Mr. Kramer's irritation, though he suppressed it, but his clerk was very nice to us. One penny was a rule, was about the extent of our investments as we went along, but a good bit of our life was led in that vicinity. Uh, I've mentioned about liking to read Nick Carter. I don't recall Diamond Dick, but I do Old Sleuth and Frank Merrill. I've mentioned the organ boy at the church. 21, the comment as to carrying bats for Harry Wilhelm, who was the pitcher of the amateurs, I don't recall. It might well be so, because I went to all the games. 22, commenting on Professor Lee Smith's interest in me despite my poor entrance examinations, I think is a little misleading. I don't think Professor Smith took very keen interest in me until I achieved a little success at the Virginia Military Institute, and later on when I got a little national prominence. He was a very fine man and very forbearing with me. I remember my father taking me to his house where he examined me to see what room in the public school I should go into when I was transferred from private school to public school, for financial reasons, I might mention. And I know my father suffered very severely by my inability to answer so many questions, which to him were very simple and to me were an enigma. I was, as I've said before, very poor in my studies at that time. Unless it was history and things that you'd read of that nature, it was... I didn't come up to the scratch at all. As I say, my sister always disagrees with me on this and says that I say this as a sort of a reaction of mock humility, but that isn't so at all. I was just very poor. And I'll tell now what happened to me that really transformed me. I was very anxious to go to the VMI. My brother had finished there with considerable merit in his performances academically. I heard him, I didn't tell this, did I?
Yes, you did, but go ahead. I think you ought to repeat it, General. There's something left out.
Sergeant tells me I've just told this. I overheard him advising my mother against sending me there because I would ruin his record. And I think I added, in telling it, that I got ahead of his record because he held no military rank and I was first captain. And I think I was one stand ahead of him in my graduation record, despite the fact that I... graduated, that I was about 100, I was 35th in a class of about 135 or thereabouts in my first year. I don't recall any particular overnight camps except one, and that was merely across the creek. And in after recollections, it was rather amusing. The National Guard came to camp near our place, and of course, all the boys immediately became very military. My brother, who was 6 years older than I was, and his friends made a gunny sack tent with a gunny sack tent fly in front. And they put it up across the creek. And they were going to spend the night in it. And, of course, I wanted to go, too. The only rifle they had was a crossbow gun. There were no ordinary air rifles of that day. And they made a track back and forth in front of the tent fly where number one walked his post and called out, "Number one, and all is well." They were very antagonistic to have me go to camp with them, but I succeeded with my mother's influence in being taken. And early in the game, I got pretty sleepy, but they were being very military. They were very much upset once by an enemy attacking, which developed into a cow. And about that time, I went to sleep. What happened after that, I didn't see. But I believe maybe the cow came in there. In any event, the garrison fled. They fell off the bank. It was a high-cut bank into the creek and dispersed and all went home. And my brother arrived a little bit wet at home. And when my mother inquired where I was, he had to admit he had left me high and dry across the creek. My father was perfectly furious and made him go with him while they recovered me and saved my life. They found me sound asleep. I had missed the entire affair. And acquired some ill will on the part of my brother because he had been punished, he had gotten wet, and I had merely slept through this great military adventure. 23, what kind of fish did we catch? Well, they were, in the earliest days, they were just chubs or large minnows, and then when we got into the mountains, they were trout. And I don't remember any larger fish, and we got into bass in the Occoquan River when I was about 10, I suppose, at that time. We hunt as to 25. We used to hunt quail, and that region was filled with quail at that time. I had an old gun of my father's. It had hammers on it instead of being hammerless, and his own gun was a very fine one, which he later gave to me, which was hammerless. I think he paid, which was a very big price for those days, about $300 for it. Now, a gun like that would cost about $1,500, because I remember it had two sets of barrels, and I was very envious of it, and had a very beautiful stock. Of course, we shot rabbits and squirrels and things of that nature, but we hunted assiduously, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and so did my chum. 26, we had sleigh rides and skating on the various ponds. I never learned to skate very skillfully because the skating was not sufficiently good. Some of my acquaintances, not my immediate friends, did learn to skate better. I had very poor skates. You have to hitch them onto your shoes and they're always falling off or tearing the sole off. But such a thing as skates of shoes, which the skate was almost a permanent part, were unheard of by our crowd. We had Sunday school picnics, of course, which were the conventional one with all the cake and lemonade and stuff in the world, and also a ball game that they would fix up. And these were in the mountain. And the sleigh rides were largely large wagon with runners put on it, and straw and hot bricks and a jolly crowd. We had those quite often. 27, we did not look for Indian relics. We were perpetually hunting Indians, and we were going where they had been and where their chiefs had been in consultation with Washington. But we didn't, as I recall, find any relics. 28, no memorable picnics. I know we would go to mountain suppers, which cost us, I think, 75 cents, maybe not that much. And I remember one place called the Stone House, which was only about a mile from Barrick's grave. And on a moonlight night, we would walk out there with a particular girl after supper and sit on the fence and cogitate, or whatever was the procedure of that day. 29. I never took part in any school dramatics, and I think I've explained about the afternoon recitals, which were very painful to me. I did not have a horse. 30. My brother had a pony for a while, which threw me once or twice so hard that I didn't do much riding, though I was very young at the time. And the trouble was, when I would get on the horse, he would scare it because he didn't want me to ride it, and the horse promptly put me out of business. 31, I don't recall any particularly. 32, I had a particular interest in Christmas, and I think our family had the most delightful Christmases I have ever seen in a family. All my friends had Christmas morning, and the tree was lit just before daylight, and they got out of bed, and their parents had worked half the night on the tree, and then they had the daylight would come, and the candles would dim, and they'd have to put them out, and they'd see their presents, and then they'd go back to bed. With us, it was quite different. We had a very large dining room, which opened through a rather open, not exactly a square hall, but a considerable hall, into the library. We didn't have dinner that night, and we were confined to the library while Father and Mother trimmed the tree, which is on the far side of the dining room, the dining room table having been pushed aside out of the way. The tree always had the same thing at the base, a white bare rug, and the presents were put around the base of the tree, and of course there were all sorts of decorative illuminations in the tree. But as I recall, very few presents were put in the tree. Almost all of them were on the white fur rug and beyond that. If there was any particular thing that could show up, it would be featured. For instance, there was generally something I was crazy about. I remember once they gave me a theater, and it came from the big toy store in Pittsburgh. It was a beautiful theater and had very attractive scenery. And they set the stage for this forest scene with the characters on the stage, and the thing I delighted in was it had footlights, which were pretty dangerous, incidentally, but you could light these things. And when the door was opened and we were introduced to our Christmas tree across the room, here was the tree on this white fur rug, and here were the tinsel and the glitter about it and on it, and then the presence at the foot, and there featured was the theater lit up by its own footlights, which looked magnificent to me. I remember when they gave me my first toy typewriter, that was featured. And in the same way, each year was something, as a rule, that I was crazy about, and was I being the youngest, much the youngest, was always favored in the display. I can always remember my sister when she got a little chip diamond ring. It was certainly a chip, as you can already see it. But when she opened this, she was standing near the sideboard. And against the side of the sideboard, between the wall and the sideboard, were stacked up all the leaves of the table. And when she opened this box and saw this chip diamond ring, she began screaming, a diamond, and upset the table leaves, which landed on the floor with a great crash, and was altogether a very thrilling Christmas scene. My brother got in trouble when he got his roller skates and began dashing around the dining room in those. And, of course, I right away wanted them, as I seemed to want anything that the others got. And too often, I think I was allowed to have them. But these Christmases were delightful. We could eat all the fruit we wanted. We eat all the candy we wanted. We hadn't had dinner. And we could have our friends in. So we had, to me, a perfectly charming evening, of which I still have the most acute and delightful recollections. And my going to my friend's house in the dim dawn of the morning were very dismal scenes to me compared to the very delightful animation and charm of the Christmas at home. Fourth of July was just Fourth of July. I generally had a couple of cigar boxes full of my firecrackers and things of that sort. And I remember one Christmas for some explainable, one Fourth of July, for some unexplainable reason, they all exploded on me and left me without anything very early in the day. We had some cannon crackers. We couldn't have many of them because they cost too much for us, but we delighted in a heavy report. We weren't allowed to have a little cannon. I did have one, but there'd been so many accidents with them that my father put a taboo on the toy cannon. We had fireworks at night that we put up from our yard, and spin wheels and things of that sort, and the public fireworks didn't come along till very, very much later. You made your own amusement in my day rather than depend on the town for it. Maybe that was better because it let the poor folk in, which our procedure did not. .33, as to the favorite articles of clothing, I don't remember. I think in my youth I was very fond of some boots with brass toes. I liked those very much, and I was particularly fond of black shirts because you didn't have to wash when you wore a black shirt. Well, the mother discovered the black was coming off, the dye was coming off all over my waist, and she couldn't scrub it off me. So she called a halt on the black shirts. I don't remember any particular cap except that we liked a cap with a visor. But the visors weren't so common in my day. We didn't play many games by the fireside. We all had checkers, of course, and we had dominoes, and we played a little casino. But mostly by the fireplace, we would have an iron upside down and a hammer and be opening hickory nuts. And incidentally, we always cleaned all the hickory nuts for Mother's very famous hickory nut cake. Walnuts were easy to open, and we would go and get them, and it'd be quite a long time before our hands would clean up from the yellow stain which came from opening the walnuts. I always liked our fires because we had what was called cannel coal, and it made a soft, delightful, home-like flame to it, and it was very agreeable to sit in front of. Later on, when natural gas was piped in, the fireplace lost a great deal of its charm, also of its efficiency. .35, we participated in the conventional Halloween performance, but not so much as to make any particular impression on me. We upset the usual outhouses and things of that sort. My favorite books were of a historical nature. I don't mean just histories, but books that bore on history. The Henty books, I read all of them, I think. And my early Punic War history of Italy is largely based on the Henty books and things of that sort. Yes, 37, we had to learn the catechism. catechism at Sunday school, and I could recite it. And I remember my old great aunt paying me a certain sum when I learned finally to recite the catechism. Incidentally, she was a highly educated woman and very thirsty regarding knowledge, and determined that I should be well educated. So she began teaching me at about 5 years old, and she so soured me on study and teaching that I like to never recover from it, because I'd be held by her chair while she taught me, and I could see out in the street my friends playing. That is particularly horrible to me on Saturday mornings. 38, we were very regular in our church attendance, and I, as a growing boy, took a very leading part in the young church work of that day. I was very fond of the minister, Mr. Whiteman, which I've already explained, and I did as many things as I could about the church, around the church. 39, I would not say the discipline at school was very harsh. Certainly Miss Thompson in the elementary school was severe in words with this, but that was about all. I don't ever recall her whipping anybody. Now, in public school, they did administer the rod very severely. I didn't get licked, which I expect is to my discredit, because it doesn't exactly indicate a very adventurous sort. But there were some that got very heavy lickings, and they used to make them sit down and put their hands behind the bench, and they would lick them across between the knees and the waist. My principal trouble in school was I was ashamed of my lack of knowledge and the superior knowledge of those around me. And I was always afraid of being embarrassed when I was questioned and I couldn't answer the question. 40, there were some dramatic performances, but they were for an older group than myself. My brother used to take quite a leading part. He was very amusing on the stage in such characteristics, and he played the end man in the Elks Minstrels for some years, particularly after I left home. 41. I don't recall our having a phonograph, but I think we must have. We had a music box, which my father bought when we were stony broke, and my mother was terribly shocked because it was the barrel wheel type with the little prong sticking out and only played 9 tunes. It played those beautifully, and they were very attractively suggested, but it had a very limited use, and it cost quite a bit of money, and it was a great extravagance. My favorite tunes were largely those of my mother's production. She played very regularly, almost every night, and I enjoyed the music immensely. Hers was good music, semi-classical music, and I finally met my first wife through hearing her playing some of the airs my mother had played, which I had come devoted. And I immediately set about meeting this girl who was playing so beautifully these airs. Incidentally, the first Miss Marshall was one of the finest amateur pianists that I've ever known, and she couldn't hardly read a note. She studied for years under Robine, who wrote a number of the light semi-operas of that day, Jack and the Beanstalk, and things of that sort. And he didn't want to disturb her rendition, and she'd begun playing when she was 5 years old, sitting on several large books, including a dictionary. Just where she inherited her music, none of them could find out, but she was a magnificent pianist. 40. I didn't play any instrument, though I could pick out airs on the piano and on the banjo and on the guitar. But there was something missing in my music. It seemed to me there was a basic chord missing. And while I played in harmony, yet I couldn't extend it very much. My brother played, my sister played, my sister played and sang, and I was in deep trouble because when she came back from school in Philadelphia, and I was in the pew next to her in church, she sang with a decided tremolo, and which I guess was an affectation. And anyway, because they were very self-conscious at that day. Whatever it was, I imitated it. And she was perfectly furious and had Father put me out of church. We summered in the mountains, the chestnut ridge of the Allegheny Mountains. To the top of the mountain from home was only about a little short of 4 miles. The actual slope of the mountain measured up to the top was about 2.5 miles, and your horse had to proceed to walk. At the foot of the mountain was a town called Monroe, and then it is only about a mile or a mile and a half straight in to Uniontown. There were several of these old mountain houses where the people farmed and lived through the winters, and they were generally prosperous, and they took boarders in the summer. And it was very delightful to live there. You got rich food, lots of it, and your pursuits were very homely, largely in walks. We used to play Indians there because it was the Indian country with the Indian tradition all around you. And we would usually go there in the summer. 43, I don't recall any. 44, did you play at war as a child? Yes. I didn't have any toy soldiers that I recall very much, but we did build forts, and we played at that sort of thing, till finally my father caught us shooting each other in the pants, corduroy pants with air rifles, and so he suppressed hostilities right then before we lost an eye. 45, I've answered. 46, I've answered. 47, were you awkward and gawky growing up? Yes. I had very large feet. I was cursed with my feet. I find now that they're not particularly large. In fact, some people comment on the smallness of my feet. But they were a burden to me when I was a boy, and made fun of me a great deal. We didn't wear long trousers in those days. We wore stockings and shoes, which made the shoe appear very much larger and your whole procedure very much more awkward. No. He had a number of very choice books, and we had a great many plain novels, but I wouldn't say he had a fine library. I read largely the magazines that came home. That's the Century Magazine, the Harper's Magazine, which were predominant in that day, and I don't remember quite what others. Muncie's Magazine came out when I was very young, and I remember it, amazingly, it sold for 10 cents, and I enjoyed it quite a lot, because it had sort of a variety of material in it. 50. The Civil War wasn't much discussed. We were rather remote from it there in Uniontown. I used to always walk out to the cemetery in my bare feet, follow the parade on Decoration Day, but the speeches were too much for me, and I would leave in a hurry. But it left quite an impression on my mind, these graves on Decoration Day. And when the brief periods that I listened to the oratory of the day gave me a flash into what it meant to that community, though it is very remote from it as compared to places in the South. When I went to the VMI, I remember hearing Early make a speech that was almost treason in its enthusiasm for the Confederacy and its condemnation of the North. The whole thing was very intense there, even in those days, and it wasn't very tactful of you to have much to say about the fighting in the war between the states, as they very carefully termed it. I didn't see the battlefield of Gettysburg in my VMI days. We went to the battlefield of New Market, and my first year there, the first months there, and my principal recollection is that I had to carry two upperclassmen's rifles, and there was a great deal of marching in order to get to the place. I remember the next time I went there, I'd gone by it several times, but you had to get into it to really see the real scene of the battle. I took General Pershing in on his way down to the VMI, and I couldn't find the scene of the charge. I had gotten it confused in my mind with a steep hill, and I was looking for a steep hill, and I found the steep hill, but I found nothing to remind me of the fight. Actually, I was way back in the region of the first deployment, and the general was waiting out in a car outside of this farm where I stopped, and in the farmyard was a tall, angular, Lincolnian frame individual with a halfway beard, and the beard and his cheeks were somewhat stained with tobacco juice. So I went back in and asked him if he had been there at the time of the Battle of Newmarket, and he said he had, though he was very cagey about saying anything. And I asked him if he'd seen the cadets. He said, yes, I watched him march by on that hillside right there. Well, I said, did he see the battle scene where they charged? No, he didn't. He didn't see that. Then he said, I said, outside here, waiting to be shown some of the battle scene, is General Pershing. He commanded all our troops in Europe. And he made no reply to that. He just spat a little tobacco juice. Well, I wasn't getting anywhere, so I repeated again. I said, outside is General Pershing, who commanded all our troops in Europe. He's going up the VMI. This fellow looked at him. He says, I heard you the first time. That's all I ever got out of him. And General Pershing told that, I remember, up at the VMI and made quite a hit with its amusing flavor. I don't recall my first trip to Washington, unless it was the time I went up from the VMI to try to get an appointment to a new commission, and you had to have an appointment for that in those days, though after you got that, you had to take an examination. I had one of my father's cards, and I remember now as an amusing recollection that I called on these various peoples, and I just had to do it sort of any way I could. I didn't have anybody except Philander Knox, who was then just appointed Attorney General, was afterwards to be Secretary of State, and he was a friend of my father's, though I'd never seen him, and he'd just been appointed. I got into his office with my card, but I got nothing out of him, and my trouble always was getting the card back. Have I told this before?
No, sir, I don't remember.
The nicest one that I encountered, though I wouldn't, there was nothing particularly nice in his manner, but I called at the house of the chairman of the military committee, Captain Hull, and I think I got in there because Mrs. Marshall's brother had married Captain Hull's niece, and a reception was going on, and yet Mrs. Hull took me in and took me upstairs to the den where Mr. Hull was resting, and he took time to talk to me, though he didn't promise me anything much. I thought I told how I got into the White House, didn't I?
Yes.
I went to the White House, and I had no appointment of any kind, and the office was on the second floor, which is now among the bedrooms and sitting rooms, upstairs private sitting rooms, of the President. I think the President's bedroom, as I know it, Mr. Roosevelt's day, must have been Mr. McKinley's office. And the old colored man asked me if I had an appointment. I told him I didn't, and he said I never would get in. Wasn't any possibility. And I sat there and watched people go in by appointment, I suppose 10 or 15, stay about 10 minutes, and then be excused. And finally, a man and his wife and daughter went in with this old colored man escorting them, and I attached myself to the tail of the procession, and that way I gained the President's office. The old colored man didn't see me, or did see me, I think, and frowned on me when he went out, and I stood pat. And after these people had met the President, they merely wanted to meet him and shake hands with him. They went out and left me standing there. And Mr. McKinley, in a very nice manner, said, what did I want? And I stated my case to him. I don't recall exactly what I said. But from that, I think, flowed my appointment. Rather, my authority to appear for examination. '53, I was athletically inclined in my teens, but not talented. I couldn't play baseball because I had a defective arm, which the tendons had been pulled, and it had gotten out of the main joint and seemingly formed a special joint. We had no x-rays in those days, and they didn't find this for a long time till they noticed this lump on the side of my arm, which has gradually shrunk up, but it persisted very heavily for my first years, and I know at the VMI my arm was very sensitive. I never could strike out straight with it, and I couldn't throw. I had to bowl. I played baseball I played some ball as much as I could, but I wasn't very popular as a member of a team on account of my inability to throw. I caught very well. I used to catch back at the bat, but they wanted more prowess in batting than I possessed. I played football on the private school local team, and I wasn't a pronounced success at that. I was too light, and they had some grown men on the team, though my friend Herb Bowman played very well, considering his lightweight at the time. When I went to the VMI, my mother made me promise for 2 years not to risk this arm in playing, and at the end of 2 years, I told her I thought that I had done that, and that she might now let me use my own judgment, which she did, and I made the team that first year I tried for it. I made it my third day out for the team, or second day, I think, and continued on the team until I graduated. 55. I've never gone into genealogy. In fact, it rather bored me, and I was also rather sensitive about it. My father was so keen in family interests that I was rather sensitive about it, because I was embarrassed by his keenness, and I thought the continual harking on the name of John Marshall was kind of poor business. It is about time for somebody to swim for the family again, though he was only a collateral relative. 55. Of course, I had boyhood ambitions, but they gradually centered on the Army as I grew older. But a railroad engineer appealed to me, and I worked a little as a civil engineer when I was very young, merely being a rodman, steady rodman at that. The cowboy wasn't so prominent in our life in those days because we didn't have much cowboy literature. I was not interested in banking. I was interested in the railroad engineer, largely from the view that my very young friend Mary Kate O'Brien's father was a railroad engineer, as I've described. 56.